Welcome everyone, and welcome back to another episode here in Singapore, day one of our event. I am Claudio Gennaro, I will be your host for today, and I have more guests for this other episode here. Litsi, Late, Lee, Francis from Irrational Agency. I was saying before, that's a really nice name for an agency.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us something about yourself? Who wants to start, and about what you do at Irrational?
Why don't I start? So I am the founder at Irrational Agency, started it in 2012. I'm a behavioral scientist and I also a mathematician. And so I founded the agency to bring some of the secrets of unconscious behavior and psychology and behavioral science into the market research world and using mathematics to model them so we could do it all quantitatively. I'm joined here by Francis, who's a colleague of mine, and Lizzie, who is or was a client of ours until very recently. And Lizzie, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Lizzie. I used to work at Vodafone in the UK as head researcher of their products and services division. But I've worked with Lee, I think it's about 10 years now. I think we've got 10-year anniversary coming up. So I first started working with Lee and Irrational when I was at IHG. And it feels a long time now. But yeah, the reason I now no longer work with Lee is because I've just left Vodafone and have just now moved to Singapore. So I am available for work if I want to be. I haven't decided yet.
Good. And Francis?
I'm Francis. I work with Lee at Irrational. I'm a behavioral science researcher and senior research executive there. Work day to day on behavioralizing traditional market research methods, and we use behavioral science throughout our research projects with different clients and work on improving those methods day to day.
So I'm totally in the darkness when it comes to behavior applied to market research. Can you tell me something about that? How does it work?
Well, behavioral science is all about uncovering the unconscious aspects of human decision making. So everybody has got things going on in their brain that are under the surface that you don't really know about. And so traditional market research, you ask people questions. Say, tell me, do you like this product? Or tell me about how much do you recycle? But that only accesses the top part, the conscious part of people's brain. And so behavioral methods are all about getting to the secrets that are hidden underneath, the things that people don't know or they can't tell you if you just ask in a survey. And so we use all sorts of methods, both qualitative methods where we ask questions in a certain way to uncover the things that from people's past or the dreams or the thoughts that they have that they don't know, or we use online methods to get people's unconscious reactions to different stimulus, different pictures, different words, and find out some of their secrets. Francis is actually here because he's developed a project about testing different types of research methods to see which ones are more effective. And so he's competing in the Young SMR Award. He's nominated for that. So do you want to tell us about that project?
Yeah, so as you say, so we have a number of different behavioral science methods which we used. And so what I did with my recent project is to test a lot of those different methods. And that involved testing five different methods within a survey. And what we did to test those is we actually brought behavior into the survey. So what that meant is putting adverts, which we sell to customers, in the survey. So usually when you put a survey to customers, you just ask them, would they buy the product? And that's the end of it. You get a 70% appeal score and then you put it to the client. But here we actually have the advert, so we can see their claim results for the different methods, whether they found it really appealing. But we can also see, well, did they actually go on to buy it? And that allowed us to look at the relationship between their claimed survey results, what they said they would do, and the actual behavior of whether they bought it or not. And so we think it can offer more insight by bringing that behavior into the research.
And Lizzie, are we...
From the client side, yes.
Lizzie and I are presenting tomorrow about some new stuff we developed at Vodafone, a new innovation process. So Lizzie can tell you something about that.
Yeah, so I joined Vodafone in 2020 and it was a very traditional type of research where, despite the fact we were asking customers about products that didn't even exist yet, we were trying to sell stuff that we tried to explain like two sentences and just hope they instantly understood it, then we would in effect say, how likely are you to buy it? And Vodafone would in the main take that data at face value. So when I kind of came into Vodafone, I thought that's insane, because you can see by looking at previous studies where Vodafone has launched products that have been very unsuccessful, despite the market research saying this will be successful. And I suspect vice versa, that some very potential products have been killed because market research said, no, we don't think customers will buy it. Whereas actually, maybe they would if it was marketed or communicated in the right way. So I think taking a behavioural approach when you're trying to sell something that doesn't exist is really important, to try and get both at that conscious, but actually those unconscious motivations, and really understanding your customer helps you have more confidence in potential new products and services that will hopefully make the company money. That's what it's all about.
So without having to tell any company secret to everyone, how do you uncover hidden behaviors? Well, what are some methodologies that we can apply?
Well, we've got three. Pardon me. I'm all right, thanks. We've got three things we're going to talk about tomorrow, and that we worked with Vodafone on. One of them is this idea of narrative qual. So qualitative research often is about asking questions, but instead we get people to tell stories. So if they tell a story about their lives, a story about the, how they use their mobile phone, and we might share some stories with them to help them to open up, we find that people reveal a lot more in storytelling than they do in questions. And then on the quantitative side, we use a tool, among other things, a tool called System 3. And System 3 is our way of getting people to reveal the unconscious associations that they have, which in turn drive how they see the world, and they drive the models of the mental model of the world that people have, the narratives that they have, the stories that they tell, and we use System 3 to uncover their how they imagine the world, and how they imagine, for example, the role that a new product could play in their lives.
That's System 3.
That's right.
How about System 1 and 2?
So System 1 and 2, many listeners might be familiar with books like Thinking Fast and Slow from Daniel Kahneman, where he's explored he calls System 1 the unconscious mind, and System 2, which is the logical mind that follows the rules of mathematics and arithmetic. We think that those two only cover part of the brain, and there's a third area, which is how people use their imaginations, how they tell stories. And we think that you need new tools and a new model to understand that, and that's what we call System 3.
Yeah, exactly. So System 1, it's more about quick decisions that you'd make instinctively, rather than like rational decisions which you'd take time over, deliberate over. And System 3 is really as a response to looking at that model and what can be added to it in decision making. So there's certain decisions which don't necessarily fall into this System 1, which is quick decisions. Neither do they fall into like this long deliberation. There's a kind of, when people make decisions, they the imagination aspect to it, of imagining how they would use this product in a different scenario. And so at the company, we're able to like tap into another kind of aspect of decision making, which isn't covered by those first two models, which are well known in behavioral science, like more broadly within the industry.
There's no System 4.
Oh, well, not yet. We'll leave that to the next generation of researchers to discover.
Lee's working on that.
My question is, coming from a mathematical background, how does it help understanding these hidden behaviours?
So mathematics is very useful in a couple of ways. So all researchers use mathematics in statistical analysis, at least if you're doing quantitative analysis. So there are some well-known tools for looking at comparing to different groups of people, see if there's a statistically significant differences between them, and many researchers will be familiar with that. Mathematics also allows us to build models, to build formal models of certain hypotheses you might have. So this idea about imagination, you could talk about imagination in a very conversational way. You could say, well, people's imagination is creative, it's colourful, it's got images of the world. But you could also think mathematically, well, how would we measure the structure of imagination? And that's what then allows you to access it in a more quantitative and a more rigorous way. And so we draw imagination out as a kind of a graph. It looks a bit like a mind map, if you've heard of mind maps, with different concepts and the connections between different concepts. And mathematics allows you to build that model and to therefore measure and understand imagination or stories or narratives in a way that you wouldn't be able to do just from a conversational basis.
Anything you want to add?
Just on System 3, the way it sort of understood System 3 and came to know it and work with System 3 is kind of when you're in that moment of making a decision, being able to think about the future through imagination to kind of visualize how that decision would impact you kind of later down the line. Yeah.
I think from a client point of view, do you find that mathematics and numbers make it easier to sell an idea?
Oh my God, yes. So I would say probably with the exception of, I mean, slightly stereotypical here, apologies, but almost your marketing teams will love the narrative and the stories and the videos and the bringing the consumer to life. Your commercial and your product managers want robust numbers that they can put into a business case and have confidence that the huge amounts of money that they're going to invest in a product and ultimately in marketing as well will succeed. So absolutely, the number of projects that we've all, as you know only too well, Lee, where we've almost had the answers from the qual, but we've had to do quantitative to tick the stakeholder box has been really important. And sometimes it has been a bit of a, right, we know the qual is right, but we're going to do this just to help get that embedded in the organisation. And sometimes the pieces like System 3 or indeed going straight to something like a behavioural conjoin has taken us straight to those kind of numbers. There's no doubt about it. Numbers make people feel more confident about using insight and research to make decisions.
And can I ask a question?
Yeah. You may.
So so that need for numbers, is that down to they need to show someone the that they're working with to like prove what they believe in? So
I
say, like, I'm on board with you, but I need a graph to show to someone, or I need something that shows this number.
I think it took me quite a while in client side to realise, even if you think you're working with someone senior, they've got someone more senior but who will know very little about the ins and outs of the project. So the people who are actually working on the project will probably be really comfortable with something like qualitative and go, it feels right. That's great. It doesn't help sell it if you need to go to the board and you can give them 2 minutes to go yes or no to investment funds. So yeah, absolutely. Every senior person has got someone else more senior that they need to convince. And numbers that go, big numbers, but say yes, do this, are much easier than, well, people sort of say that they, you know, those kind of, those qualitative insights that are so critical in the actual implementation, but in terms of actually getting a go, no-go decision are really critical.
Yeah, I often think that when sort of composing, working on the project, composing the report, when you've got like deep qualitative insights and thinking, are these going to get lost when it goes to that senior level?
Yeah.
When they see that report, no, they won't understand the full context, the full,
the
full qualitative insight that you put into it and... What they would...
Yeah, it sometimes can be a bit depressing when you see all that hard work all that nuance distilled in three numbers.
Yeah.
But to be fair, if it gets it through, then actually that doesn't matter. And almost I have to kind of slightly remove myself from that almost, you know, the bias that I've got from all the investment. But no, you should know about this and you should know about that. Actually, it doesn't matter. If the person who needs to make the decision makes the decision and then the rest of the team are empowered by the insight to implement it in the best possible way to maximize the success, then fine.
That's a great tip for dealing with client sides, how to present the project, right? So it really makes a lot of sense. I guess it's really helpful to know, always perceive and what are the key information that needs to be
received. And you can actually use a little bit. We had a webinar recently called Selling Insights where we talked about using behavioral science on your stakeholders, because your stakeholders are consumers like everyone else. They have their own psychology and their own unconscious biases. And if you can use, for example, the what's called the authority bias, where, well, a scientist said this, so it must be true, then it can go a long way to making people believe what you're saying.
Okay, we need to talk about AI.
Okay.
Oh, right. Well, let's get the next set of guests in there.
Something we're always asking. How are you implementing, or did you implement any kind of AI in your daily activity?
This one, well, Francis, do you want to talk about your project first?
Yeah, so I've got an example of the way we use AI in the recent project that I mentioned earlier that we're testing. So that's we did sentiment analysis. We basically take a series of open-end comments from respondents. Yeah, 100 different comments, different talking about different things. And obviously, there's no numerical score on that. So there are like AI tools we can use to turn that into a numerical score in terms of their sentiment. So it would put a different like weight to, if they say, this product's incredible, I would definitely buy it. That would be 0.9 out of between 0 and 1 on the scale. And then, you know, maybe I would buy it, might be like 0.5, for example. So there's AI tools that can do that quite rapidly, where previously you have to, well, in other ways doing it without AI, you have to use like lexicon like models. It's quite time consuming to use. Mm-hmm. So it can help quicken up that process.
What I'm interested in is almost getting into the psychology of the AI. So treat the AI as if it was a person and see what's the unconscious mind of the AI going to do. And if we can then teach the AI to think more like a person by saying, okay, we surveyed 1,000 people, we got into their unconscious mind. We're going to program the AI to take those insights, and then we can get the AI to act like a person. To act like one of, say, a Vodafone consumer or subscriber, and say to the AI, well, now tell us, what would that person do in this new situation? Do you know if Vodafone had been doing any AI experiments?
We're talking about synthetic data.
Well, so kind of synthetic data, but built from real people's data. So, yeah, programmed, taking the real people to make the synthetic model.
I think Vodafone was starting to look at it in the core business, less so in products and services. Right. I think it was still very early days. I think we probably depended more on almost working with agencies who were offering AI tools. So there was certainly a little bit of experimentation, nothing that has revolutionized or dramatically changed the approach that Vodafone, that the part of Vodafone I was working was using. But I think I'm sure there will be.
I have actually used some AI to create the images for tomorrow's presentation. So we've got a few. Actually, I haven't shown you this, Lizzie.
Yeah. But
I've made a rendering of you as the hero of our journey, fighting the monster.
Oh my God, I love AI already. I mean, yes, my main use of AI is actually rewriting very badly written concepts for my stakeholders. So less for research, more for improving what should be bread and butter for some of my stakeholders. So actually it has been very useful, but yeah, probably not in the way that it will be in maybe a year to 2 years.
Yeah, and we another use for it that we have at the company, not specifically within project work, but note-taking in kind of from meetings. You can get the AI to do that. I think they've actually now integrated it within Zoom. There are other platforms that do it, like create like summaries and next steps to do. You can imagine using that in actually like research with qualitative research, but based on some of the AI results we've had from the meetings, I don't know how successful that would be.
Probably about 80 or 90%. Yeah. To be fair, sometimes when you get a person to take the notes from the meeting, they only get 80% right anyway. So, you know, it's not really much worse.
Yeah, I think they get it wrong kind of in a different way.
That's true.
Yeah.
Is there any specific tool that you wish you had and you don't have yet when it comes to AI?
Ooh. I think, well, you're asking us to invent the next AI startup here.
We copyright it.
Well, yeah, maybe we should keep that to ourselves.
Instead
of giving away our ideas to
all of us. Anyway,
I think I would like I would actually like to put an AI into the hands of some clients so that when they ask a research question, it will, first it will find if they already have the answer in their existing library, because you know, as you will know, there could be hundreds of studies in a client that already answer a lot of questions, but then it will tell them, okay, here's the gaps where you could do with more data, and then it would come to us with that gap and say, here's exactly what you need to, the gap you need to fill to help this client. So that would be a nice way of helping the client to work with what they already have and enhance it with the extra insights that we can provide.
Yeah. I think it's sometimes with those tools, it's kind of a be careful what you wish for situation, because I've been doing reports and I've really wanted, oh, I wish an AI could kind of finish this report off or get the ideas in my mind down on the and into the report. But then you don't want to give away too much power to the AI, because I kind of happy in my job laying out myself, and I don't want the AI to take over my role.
Easily, Francis, thanks a lot for joining. Best of luck for your participation to the Young ASMR Society Awards.
Thank you.
And hope you will enjoy the rest of the conference.
Lovely speaking.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Did you like it?
Well, there you go.
Have you got the app?
No, I've got the app.